He studied with Bunsen, Robert Bunsen, in Heidelberg, and everybody knew it. And he told how a young fellow coming into the Bunsen's laboratory for the first time as a graduate student. Bunsen blew his own glassware. I did that in Nobel Institute. Blew his own glass, so his hands got to be like rhinoceros eyes. And he could handle hot. One of my sadistic delights is when a waitress hands me a plate and says, "Be careful, it's hot," is to grab it. "Oh, sir, I thought it was hot." "Oh!" So I could still handle hot plates because of that. And Bunsen would handle, the first day the student came in, would be blowing a big glass tubing and would say, "Hold this for a minute, will you please?" And the student, and it would break. He said, "Young man, before you leave this laboratory, you'll be able to hold hot tubes like this." Now, the other story he told was glucinium. This was was that gallium? I'm not sure. But it was called glucinium. It has another name now. I'm trying to think whether it was gallium. I'm not sure. And he said it was Winkler, W-I-N-K-L-E-R, Winkler. And this is the Freiburg School of Mines, F-R-E-A-B-U-R-G, School of Mines. Because, you see, analytical chemistry and mineralogy was a thing that left over from 1880 to 1925, you see. Winkler was studying this very rare material, glucinium, and he made up a solution, and he was filtering it. Then he would take this, he would take and ignite the filter paper and the precipitate and weigh it. And every filter paper had a constant weight, and you knew. Subtract the weight of the filter paper, and you knew what the weight of the solid was. But as he was doing this, suddenly into the room came a fly and lighted on the glucinium, which was sweet. That's why it was called glucinium, because it's like glucose, you see. And to his horror, put his proboscis in and sucked some of this precious stuff in it, as rare as could be, you know. Well, he got the fly before it flew away. And he ignited the fly and the precipitate, but the only trouble was he didn't know what the weight of a fly ash was. This is a true story. He had 20 students, and each student had to catch him 2 flies. And he took 40 flies and he ignited them, and he divided by 40 to get the weight of a fly ash, of one fly, subtracted that from that, got marvelous results. Well, he had any number of stories like that. Also, in the old school of science, chemistry building on the corner of Washington and Nassau, the Red School building, is where McKay discovered the way, the Army method for determining, in the First World War, margarine from butter. He liked to play the piano. He was a bachelor, and he liked to play the violin, I mean. And he used to go to the opera, and he came home late one day, a night from New York, and thought he'd go down to the lab and play the violin a little bit. Now, he liked late-night snacks, and he had an ice box in those days, and he had these crackers, and he'd put butter on them, and he'd eat them and play the piano. He ran short of butter one night, and he had margarine, and he spread with the margarine. But he didn't eat all of them, and he forgot and left them out on the lab desk, and he went home. And he came back the next morning, and here he noticed that all the crackers that had butter on had been eaten by the mice, but they hadn't touched the margarine. And so he set it up again the next day, and sure enough, they ate the butter but didn't touch the margarine. That became the standard Army test for margarine versus butter. Now, George Hewlett, I can't tell you any good stories about George Hewlett, but Hugh Taylor, I can tell you any number of good stories about Hugh Taylor.
How about before we get to Taylor, who we want to talk about a good deal, there were also, you mentioned Lauder Jones.
Lauder Jones sort of slopped over a little bit the last half of the 20s, Lauder Jones was the organic chemist, as far as research was concerned. Now, Sarah Sykes' father taught organic chemistry. He didn't do a great deal of research, though. I certainly wouldn't say that at different time. But Lauder Jones was doing good work. He worked with Neff in Chicago, I believe, mm-hmm. and was well known as a nitrogen specialist. And then tragedy. And he was responsible for the Frick Laboratory being built. That's an interesting story. Frick, the great steel knight, had promised Princeton, I think it was $2 million for a chemistry laboratory. It was an enormous amount of money in those days. And then he died. And the war came. And after the war, First World War, Lauder Jones came to Princeton. And he went to, it was Lauder Jones who was responsible for this, went to, Hugh Taylor told me this, so I'm sure that's true. He went to President Hibben and said, President Hibben, the chemistry department has been promised maybe $1 million laboratory, chemistry laboratory. Well, he says, we don't have it. We don't have the money. We can't give it to you. He says, but you've been promised it. What had happened was Frick left his money to Princeton but didn't earmark $1 million for the chem lab. He said, but you've been promised it. He says, I'm sorry. There was a verbal promise. We have no way of taking that money and segregating and spending. Well, he said, but you promised it. He says, well, he says, Professor Jones, if you can tell me how to raise $1 million, you will have your chem lab. He says, I will tell you how to do it. Raise tuitions. And Hibben said to him, you shall have your chem lab. And the chem lab was built on raised tuitions. Isn't that an interesting story? I'm sure it's true because Taylor told it to me. But so Lauder Jones would have made a great name for Princeton in the organ. He and Taylor in catalysis and physical chemistry, you see. Very important contributions Taylor made. And Lauder Jones in organic chemistry. But unfortunately, he went on a trip out west with his young daughter, who was in Miss Fine School. In fact, she played the violin, I played the cello with her once at Miss Fine School back when I was 18. They went on a trip, and the Grand, I think it was the Grand Canyon, one of the canyons, she got too close to the edge and fell down and caught hold of a bush. And he said, I'll help you, and he got down to catch her. And she was that close to being saved when she couldn't hold on anymore and she fell to her death. Well, he just cracked up completely. He left Princeton. He began to travel abroad. In fact, when I was studying in Berlin, he and his sister came and spent a day with him. But he did no more research, nothing more, and that was the end of it. But he had brought in Eugene Papchu, who was a wonderful sugar chemist and a wonderful teacher, and a good research man in the field of sugar chemistry, well recognized as an authority in the field, and Everett Wallace in the field of carbine and all kinds of things that Everett Wallace is responsible for. You'll have it in his. And those two carried the organic. Greg Doherty was an excellent teacher, excellent teacher. I want to tell you, so you're going to erase it. This is a good enough story to tell you. It's terrible, an old man in Remington. Hal Beatty, who was assistant president of the unleaded in Detroit. Harold Beatty and I were the only ones taking a course in natural products. Greg Doherty was to give it. This first time he had ever given lectures, just a young fellow.
As you were an undergraduate or a graduate student?
Oh, he has his PhD. He was now an assistant professor. Oh, okay. And he was to give a course in alkaloids and things like that. They didn't really have natural alkaloids in there. Enormous quantity of material. And he had a thick book like this. And he'd write on the board and he'd write. And Hal and I would write and write. And it was easy for him. He had his notes and we had. And we ended up with, I'll swear we had that many notes. And Hal came to me. He said, the one time I played ball, and I think it was wonderful. Hal came, he said, Hubert, he says, I don't know what we're going to do in that final exam. We didn't have any other exams, just one final exam. I don't know what we're going to do about that final exam. I can't possibly. It was just impossible. He said, I'll make a pact with you. He said, if you agree to write only 10 pages, I'll agree to write only 5 pages. Well, I didn't think that was against his honor system. I wasn't getting any help from him. And I am so delighted. And I was plotting sort of a fellow that I didn't say, no, Hal, I'm sorry. I'm going to write all I know. And I said, okay, Hal, it's a deal. Well, Greg came in and gave us a 3-hour exam. In about half an hour, I condensed into ten sheets more knowledge than any human being in the world has ever condensed. I did it all in outline, you see. And in half an hour, it's finished. And Hal was finished. His 5 pages, my 10 pages. And I think we sat around and smoked in those days until just 15 minutes before the exams, and then Greg came in. Well, have you young fellows finished? Oh, yeah, we finished long ago. Fine, I'll collect your papers. Well, he went in. Sure enough, I got an A and Hal got a B. Years passed. In fact, 50 years passed and Greg retired. And the day Greg retired, I said, Greg, I got something to confess to you. And I told him, humanity says you have cleared up a mystery that has been with me all my life. He says, I took your papers and I'm going to settle them. Let's see how much I can tell these young fellas. I picked up Hal's paper. 5 pages, is that all he knows? Well, let's see how much Al, yeah. 10 pages. Well, I guess that's all I can learn. He says, well, next year I got 50 and 60 pages. I thought, gee, am I getting better?
That's a good story.
That takes care of until we get to Sweden. Mm-hmm. Now, when I went to Sweden, I was the last student, Svante Arrhenius. The Nobel Institute wasn't very big. There were maybe about a dozen people working in it. And Svante Arrhenius lived right next door. And I worked very, very hard. And I might, at this moment, say the 3 Nobel Prizes when I worked with them, how completely different they were. That may be they were Svante Arrhenius, Fritz Haber, and Linus Pauling. And I'll tell you a story about each one of them as individuals. Now, Svante Arrhenius, he was 65, but in those days, that was an old man. And twice a day, he would come in to see. I was working with Beckstrom, B-A-C-K-S-T-R-M, Hans Beckstrom, who later came here when I was getting my PhD and supervised the final getting of the PhD with me. Arrhenius lived right next door, and he would come in twice a day in the morning and in the night, afternoon. Well, Mr. Elliot, what have you done today? Well, that's nice. Oh, that's nice. And have you thought of doing so-and-so? Well, I was an idiot. Of course, I hadn't thought of doing it, but it was much better than what I thought of. Yeah, I think I'll do that this afternoon. Oh, good. I could still see him shuffling away. My conscience is on me forever. That's the one time I cheated in science. Oh, good. Because I could see him as he walked away and say, gee, that's a bright young fellow. He thinks of things before I do. Just once that happened. The rest of the time, he would come in and we'd discuss what I was doing. And he had a cat. Used to come with them, and they had all these beakers, all these delicate apparatus, and that cat just loved to wind in and out, curve, and look up triumphantly when she got to the end without knocking anything over. And away you go. Now, Arrhenius, here's one of the stories he told me. When he was 18, he was working at a chemical factory one summer, and the director of research, just for fun, gave him a little vial, cork-stoppered vial, with a mercaptan, M-E-R-C-A-P-T-A-N, in it. Now, you know what hydrogen sulfide smells like? Rotten eggs. Well, mercaptan smells like 10,000 rotten eggs. It's awful. And just for fun, he says, he realizes now. He gave it to Rainey, he says, get rid of this, will you? So Rainey is on his bicycle, riding into Stockholm, threw the vial into the mailer, into the lake that surrounds in Stockholm. And he says, unfortunately, the cork came unstoppered. And the mercap spread all over the southeast portion of Stockholm. For 2 days, they had the most awful odors you could possibly imagine. He said they set up a learned chemical committee to investigate it, and after 2 weeks, they made a very learned report that something very unusual meteorologically had happened, that the sulfide pulp mills let off this SO2 and the other gases, and the petroleum on the other side had let off, and the winds had blown the two together, and they had combined and mercaptan. They recognized mercaptan, but they said it was a very unusual meteorological condition, and they didn't think it would happen again. Arrhenius said, "I knew it wouldn't happen again." Now, Arrhenius, it couldn't be in his for a minute, but realize what a sharp, bright mind he was, alert to everything that was happening. He drank too much. He never got drunk. At the Nobel dinner, because I was a Scandinavian American fellow, I had sat right up in the front row And I saw a whole long table, 15 Nobel Prize men all sitting there, and Arrhenius in the middle was a host. He'd jump up and he'd drink some beer with Franck, the German, and Segmondi, and he'd drink some French wine with Perrin, and he'd drink some tea with Rutherford, and then he drank to the American, and he toasted in water. Because we had,
prohibition,
and everybody laughed at that. And at the end of the dinner, everybody was slightly tipsy except for Arrhenius, and he was just cold sober. I mean, he was just a delightful person. He had great thoughts about, his science came first. We remember going to a very formal dinner, we were all in tux and everything, and just before they called for the dinner, suddenly there was a magnificent Northern Lights display, and nothing would do but all of the guests, and the ladies were bored stiff. Arrhenius took them all out on the lawn and proposed his theory of ionization of the cause of this magnificent thing. But he was always very excited about everything that the people in his institute was doing. He was just a delightful people. Now that's the one. He taught me to have at 82 and a half, only 83, the excitement of a 16-year-old kid. I have the same excitement that Arrhenius had when I studied with him. You can be just excited no matter what your age is if you're really excited about chemistry, you see. Yeah. Now, the second one was Fritz Haber. This was in 1930. Now, I had my PhD, and I was at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, which in Berlin, Dahlem, outskirts of Berlin, D-A-H-L-E-M, which is like the Institute of Advanced Study, you see, Haber was the director of it, like Oppenheimer, say. And I studied for the whole year, and I wrote three papers with him, a 25-page paper with him. It was a quite a fundamental paper on activated Schwalb and so on. And completely different. Stern Prussian. He would come in, "Was hast du getan heute, Herr Doctor? What do you do today, dear? Have you done so and so?" "No, aber, but, aber, Haber, aber, Haber." Now, let's first learn what Haber was. As he began on this thing, Haber is responsible for World War I beginning in 1914. There's no question about it. The politicians don't know what they're talking about when they said it was because the Archduke was murdered. Has no question about it, because he, in 1913, showed how to make ammonium nitrate. And suddenly, man, for the first time, had unlimited source of explosives. Mm-hmm. He actually made it for fertilizer because we were dying before lots of nitrogen for growing crops. And during World War I, I don't know the exact figure, probably about 3 million tons of ammonium nitrate, nitrogen from the air and hydrogen from water, to make it to ammonia. And from that, you make nitric acid, ammonium nitrate. During World War I, probably something like 3 million tons were dropped. During World War II, 9 million tons were dropped. But during peacetime, 100 million tons are distributed all over the land by the farmers. And if you think the Korea War began in 1951, you have another guess. During the war, I knew something about intelligence. I came home and said to my wife that morning, "I hope to high heavens our planes are landing in North Korea." But stupid military, they didn't get what our intelligence told them. They let the Russians take over North Korea, which was the industrial heart of Asia. Every little town had its own hydroelectric plant, and most of the aluminum of the Japanese airplanes were made in the hydroelectric plants of North Korea. We, stupid us, took over South Korea, which is a bunch of farmers, which is fine, but farmers without fertilizer. And we shipped, I know this figure is quick because one of my best friends was a military man who was responsible for this. We shipped in this is an ammonium nitrate story that acts in war and peace. From 1945 to 51, we shipped in 100,000 tons of ammonium nitrate every year to the South Korean farmers. And after 1951, we dropped hundreds of thousands of tons of ammonium nitrate explosive on North Korea. And that's, of course, why we had the Texas City explosion. You see, the ammonium nitrate we made was to be sent over to France as fertilizer. And, I don't know, 400 people were killed. Mm-hmm. Right after World War I, in Opal, the same thing happened. And Hugh Taylor said he went through, after the war, he was intelligence for England at the time. He was an English citizen. He went down there at Opal. He went through 1 mile of dunes of ammonium nitrate 100 feet high. And they caked from the rain. And somebody, stupidly, detonated to loosen it up to use it for fertilizer, and the thing exploded with dynamite, and it detonated, the whole thing went off and made a 2-block hole 200 feet deep and killed 500 people. But even worse, up in Halifax, two ships carrying the same ammonium nitrate to still be used as fertilizer instead of the first one, collided, and 2,000 people were killed. Well, that's the ammonium nitrate story. And Haber discovered the Haber-Bosch process, though it was what you had to do, he knew in 1907, it wasn't made industrially possible until the fall of 1913. And that, if France had discovered it, France would have gone 401. I don't think there's any question of it. But Germany discovered it, and they now knew they could have unloaded. The German Navy, Haber told me all this, the German Navy was annihilated 3 months after the war began, the First World War, off the coast of Chile, where all the nitrate gunpowder came from. See, until now, that's all you could fight was that gunpowder. From the, as I used to say to my students, the birds leaving more than footprints on the sand at time to smother the sodium nitrate. But now they had unlimited ammonium nitrate and could fight the war.
Did you recall any criticisms of Haber after the war by the Allies?
Oh, I'll tell you about it. We'll come to that in a minute. Haber told me they almost lost the war in the first 2 months. Their factory, something went wrong with it, and suddenly discovered they couldn't make the ammonium nitrate after the war had begun. But they discovered a shack in Belgium that had 10,000 tons of ammonium nitrate in it. They captured it, and they fought that interim with that Belgian ammonium nitrate until the Haber-Bosch plant began to produce again. Now, the next thing I tell you about Haber is into this. He gave me, in the days of if I could have only copied him, he gave me, I was very close to him, very close. I used to have, he was a multimillionaire, Nairn, I'll tell you about that too. Nairn's, whose third law made possible for Haber to do it, was just a poor professor. Haber got one pfennig for every pound of ammonium nitrate that was made, becoming a multimillionaire. And he gave me his lecture notes to his gas officers, about 150 pages. Once. I'd say, I used to have dinner with him at least twice a week, and he'd say, Mr. Ali, I enjoy you. His home was right by the Institute. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have you over here to lunch, because when I talk to you about America and what you think and so on, you always tell me what you think. I said, with my German workers, the minute I ask a question, they say to themselves, what does the Geheimrat want me to say? And then they will say it. I found this many times when I've been with great people, that I apparently have a knack of knowing they're great, that I'm here, but as human beings, we're here. Mm-hmm. I had an interview with Chiang Kai-shek and for an hour. It's supposed to be half an hour, and it turned out I was really the one that spoke, because these people were all lining up who had interviews with him. And when he came to the Minister of Education, I taught for 6 weeks there in Taiwan, and he wanted to know what I thought of chemistry in Taiwan. I'll tell you that about later. Let me get back to this. Haber said, these are the notes that I gave to the gas officers. Now, in those notes, there are two things I think are interesting that aren't in the history book. He began by accusing the Belgians of being the first one to use gas warfare. He said, for one whole year, they used bromine lacrimators, a cry gas. Mm-hmm. They used tear gas, the Belgians did, before the Germans used the chlorine. Now, the second thing is about the chlorine attack. That was on April the 22nd, when 15,000 Canadians and English were killed at Ypres, Y-P-R-E-S, Ypres. Now, Haber said it wasn't a major operation. Our major battle was on the Eastern Front, and this was just going to be sort of a diversion. He said, in fact, we hadn't dreamed it was going to be so efficient. If it had, we had the chlorine, we could have blasted away right through to the Atlantic Ocean if we had only known it was going to be that efficient, and it was going to kill, that little bit of chlorine was going to kill 15,000 troops, he said. And he said, we had the tank, the 44-pound tanks of chlorine, in the trenches, and they were there for 6 weeks because the wind wasn't blowing right. And finally, the military told us, if you don't launch it tomorrow, we're going to take them out because they're interfering with our movement in the trenches. And he said, early the next morning, you could see J. James Franck, Nobel Prize winner, photochemist, standing and holding a handkerchief aloft, and the wind was, the handkerchief was blowing toward the Canadian, and relaunched the attack and killed all these people. Now, he said 10 weeks later, I think it was, we launched an attack when we used 20 times more chlorine, and practically nobody was killed. Why? Because they instructed the soldiers to urinate on their handkerchiefs and hold it to their noses, and the urine would absorb the chlorine and save their lives. Now, the other interesting thing that isn't in the history book, I think, is very interesting. He said, you know, Dr. Allier, we Germans, the first attack wasn't April the 15th. We launched an attack in Russia 6 months earlier against the Russians. But we stupid chemists didn't realize how cold it was in Russia, and all the snow was there. And as the chlorine gas blew across toward the Russian trenches, it united with the snow and formed an octahydrate, a chlorine H2O, an octahydrate solid, and never reached the Russian trenches. And when spring came and it grew warm enough for it to evaporate, the lines were now 50 miles away and nobody realized that the chlorine evaporated. So the first chlorine attack was 6 months earlier in Russia, which I think was interesting. Here's some other things. Let me finish about the difference. So here was Arrhenius, a happy fellow, excited, and from him I learned to be excited. Here was Haber, coldly analytical. Look at Haber, but have you done some? But mach nick. And then he'd go out, come back in the afternoon. Have you done it? Yes. Yes, professor, and it's this. Sehr gut, and out he walked. Now, wunderschön, Arrhenius said, embrace me. Oh, wonderful, wonderful. No, sehr gut, how did he work? Just coldly analytical, but very tender underneath. Very tender underneath. And he told me, this isn't in the history books, he told me the history now. He told me, Dr. Allier, if you hear sometime that I have had a heart attack and die, it is not the truth. I have taken cyanide. I always carry it with me. And later, in 1933, Hitler sent him a list of the people who had to be expelled from the Institute, and they were all Jewish people that had to be expelled. And Haber, who was a Jew, he was afraid to dismiss Haber because the people lionized him. When I came back with this picture of Haber down there, and the Germans saw, ah, Geheimrat, I got this good. Go on and give me a picture. So he was afraid, Hitler was afraid to touch Haber, but he was going to throw all the Jews out. And Haber went and placed the Farkases, one in Philadelphia in an oil company, one in Israel. That Farkas showed how to soak paper in diphenyl, for wrapping up oranges. And the result was that when they had shipped oranges to England from Israel, they 90% of them went through. And in the old days, only about 15-20% went through. That was Haber. Polanyi went to England. Wigner came here to Princeton, although Wigner knew he was coming to Princeton. In fact, Wigner came to me there at the Kaiser Moment, and he said, Dr. A, I've been invited to come to Princeton. Ido Wigner. Will I have to teach freshmen? I said, no, Eugene, you'll give lectures in graduate school. Then I think I will go.
One second.
That,